ways, but they'll never let themselves be seen. Not unless they're somewhere private with a target for abuse, said Locke. On the platform below, some attendants unlocked the chests, while others took positions near the slate boards. "Fellow citizens," boomed First Magistrate Sedelkis, "honorable Conseil members and officers of the Republic, welcome. I have the honor of closing the 79th season of elections in the Republic of Carthane by reading the results into the public record. The returns by district, commencing with Issas Thedra." An attendant took an envelope from one of the chests. Sedelkis tore it open and pulled out a parchment embossed with seals and ribbons. "By the count of 115 to 60, first son Epitalus of the Deep Roots Party." Loud applause erupted from half the population of the Grand Salon. One attendant chalked the official numbers on a board, while others lit a green glowing candle and used a long pole to place it beneath the first frosted glass globe. "Do you wish to concede, madam?" said Locke. "I think that one was one of the foregone conclusions," said Sabatha. "Damn," said Locke, "she's too clever for us." "For the Isle of Hammers, by the count of 235 to 100, announced Sedelkis, "fourth daughter Dulerian for the Black Iris Party." The attendants lit and placed another candle, one that gave off a purple-blue light so dark it was a fair approximation of black. "Well, how now?" said Sabatha, pouring a fresh round of drinks. "Nothing pithy to say?" "I would never dream of pithing in front of you," said Locke. 7 green lights and 4 black lights blazed by the time Sedelkis announced, "For the Bursadi district, by the count of 146 to 122, second son Lovaris of the Black Iris Party." Jean sighed theatrically. "That poor man," said Sabatha, "so nearly victimized by unscrupulous relic thieves." "We rejoice at his deliverance," said Locke. "For the Plaza Gandolo," boomed Sedelkis, "by the count of 81 to 65, second daughter Viracoy of the Black Iris Party." "Oh, Perelandro's balls, we filled her house with stolen goods," said Jean. "She was charged with 11 counts of housebreak or receiving. What possible grease could you apply to that?"
"I came up with a story that Viracoy was secretly sheltering a distant cousin," said Sabatha, "and that this cousin was severely touched in the head, had a real mania for stealing things, even hired an actress to play the role for a few days. I had Viracoy circulate to apologize personally for the fact that her cousin had managed to slip away from supervision, and once all the stolen goods were identified and returned, all those sympathetic people quietly rescinded their charges, and discreetly talked to their friends and neighbors, of course."
"Rescinded charges," Locke shook his head. "No bloody wonder paying off the magistrate didn't get us anything."
"For the Issas Melia," announced Sedelkis, "by the count of 75 to 31, damned superstition Dexer of the Deep Roots Party."
"Didn't even bother much with that one," said Sabatha.
"Well, you did try to bribe her cook," said Locke, "and her doorman, and her footman, and her solicitor, and her carriage driver, and her tobacconist."
"I succeeded in bribing the doorman," said Sabatha. "I just couldn't find anything constructive to do with him."
"At least I won't have to eat a hat," Locke whispered to Jean.
"For the silver chase," announced Sedelkis, "by the count of 108 to 67, light of the Amethel Azalon of the Deep Roots Party."
That was the last green candle to be lit for a long time, however. The next 3 blazed black, bringing the total to 9 and 9.
"It's all theatre in the end, isn't it?" said Sabatha. The brandy had brought colour to her cheeks. "All our running around in costumes, saying our lines. Now the chorus comes out on stage to recite the moral and send the audience home."
"Half of them are about to wish they had some fruit to throw," said Jean.
"Shh, here it comes," said Sabatha.
"The final report," announced Sedelkis, opening the envelope with a flourish. For the Polenta district, by the count of 170 to 152, third son Jovindus of the Black Iris party.
The last lamp flared with dark light. 3. Consternation erupted on the floor, shouts of joy mingling with accusations, cries of disbelief and insults.
Sabitha folded her arms, leaned back in her chair, and adopted a wide, genuine smile.
"You boys gave me a closer run than I expected," she said, "and I did have the advantage of getting here first."
"That's a gracious admission," said Jean.
"Your gimmick with Lavaris would have been magnificent fun to watch," said Sabitha. "I'm almost sad I had to put my foot down on it."
"I'm not," said Locke.
"Order!" cried First Magistrate Sedelkis. "Order!"
The cloaked bluecoats surrounding the stage drove their staves rhythmically against the ground until the crowd heeded Sedelkis.
"All districts having reported, I hereby declare these results rightful and valid. Carsane has a consail. Gods bless the presence. Gods bless the Republic of Carsane."
"First Magistrate," came a voice from the crowd, "I beg a moment of stage time to amend the record in one small respect."
"Oh, what in all the hells?" said Sabitha.
The speaker was Lavaris, who separated himself from a group of happy Black Iris notables, pushed through the cordon of blue coats around the stage, and took a place beside Sedelkis at a speaking trumpet.
"Dear friends and fellow citizens," he said, while beckoning for one of the glass globe attendants to approach him, "I am second son Lavaris, often called Perspicacity, an honor I cherish. For 20 years I have represented the Borsadi district as an enthusiastic member of the Black Iris party. However, of late, I must confess that enthusiasm has been dimmed by circumstances beyond my control. I grieve that I must discuss this in public. I grieve that I must take corrective action in public."
"Is anyone else at this table hallucinating right now?" said Sabitha.
"If we are, we're sharing a lovely fever dream," said Locke. "Let's see how it ends."
"I grieve most of all," continued Lavaris, "that I must announce my reluctant but immediate withdrawal from the Black Iris party. I will no longer wear their symbols or attend their party functions."
"Gods above, are you actually resigning from the council?" shouted someone in the crowd.
"Of course not," shouted Lavaris. "I said nothing about resigning my council seat. I am the Borsadi councillor, validly and rightfully elected, as the first magistrate just announced."
"Turncoat,"
shouted a man that Locke recognized as third son Jovindus.
"You ran under false pretenses. Your election must be nullified in favor of your second."
"We elect men and women in Carthane," said Lavaris,
and it was clear from his voice that he was speaking through a smirk that would have injured a lesser man with its intensity.
"Those men and women declare party affiliations only as a matter of their own convenience. I am not bound to surrender anything. My honorable associate should more closely examine the relevant laws. Now, allow me to finish describing the new situation."
Lavaris took a pole from the attendant he'd beckoned, then used it to extinguish and dislodge the candle from the middlemost black globe. One blank white glass was left in the midst of 9 black and 9 green.
"Simply because I have left the Black Iris does not mean that I have necessarily embraced any of the positions of the Deep Roots. I am declaring myself a party of one, fully independent, a neutral balance between Carthane's traditional ideologies. I am fully willing to be convinced to any reasonable course of action in the Consail. Indeed, I remind my esteemed colleagues that my door is ever open for your approaches and entreaties. I shall very much look forward to receiving them. Good evening."
What followed could only be described as the crescendoing clusterfuck of the Carthani social season, as half the consailors of the Black Iris party
technically immune to constabulary restraint, attempted to storm the stage through a wall of bluecoats who could neither hurt them nor allow them to hurt Lavaris. First Magistrate Sedelkis demonstrated the co-equality of the Carthani judiciary by kicking a Black Aris consailor in the teeth, which brought even Deep Roots consailors into the fray to uphold the privileges of their station. Bluecoat messengers raced off to find reinforcements, while most of the non-combatant spectators refilled their goblets of punch and settled in to watch their government in action.
"I don't believe it," said Sabatha. "How the hell? I've got no more succinct way to put it. How the hell?"
"You warned Lavaris we were coming to try and convince him to change the color of his lapel ribbon," said Locke. "And you know he didn't buy that offer for an instant. He chewed on my self-respect for a while, then wiped me away like a turd."
"But we'd already prepared a second line of attack," said Jean, pouring himself a fresh finger of brandy. "Ego fodder. Something designed to appeal to his sense that he ought to be the hinge around which the rest of the world turned."
"Catnip for an asshole," continued Locke. "Jean offered the second approach on the theory that Lavaris might be more willing to parley seriously with an envoy he hadn't just pissed all over. Turned out to be a good guess."
"And now Lavaris is the most important man in Carthane," whispered Sabatha. "Now any deadlock in Consail is going to have to be resolved by his vote."
"A possibility he found quite stimulating. The other Consailers might detest his guts," said Locke, "but they will be at his door, hats in hand, for the next 5 years, or until he's assassinated. Hardly our problem either way."
"And that's all it took? A friendly suggestion?"
"Well, obviously he agreed to go through with it only if the numbers added up," said Locke. "If you'd had a wider margin of victory, he would have stayed silent. And there was one hell of a bribe to sweeten the deal."
"He settled for 25,000 ducats, said Jean.
"How does he expect to hide it?" said Sabatha. "The Black Aris are going to rake him over the coals. His counting house will be watched. His business dealings will be dissected. Any fresh property that turns up will be beaten like a dusty carpet for clues."
"Hiding it's not the issue," said Locke, "since you already safely delivered it to him for us."
Sabatha stared at him for a moment, then whispered,
"The reliquary boxes!"
"I quietly boiled 25,000 ducats down to precious stones, mostly emeralds and spider's eye pearls," said Jean. "A lightweight cargo to stash in the bottom of the drawers. Your constables were much more squeamish about digging through the dust and bones of Lavaris' forebears than he was."
"I'd thought you'd taken them to hold hostage for his cooperation," said Sabatha.
"It was the sensible conclusion," said Locke. "We didn't feel comfortable hauling a fat bribe to his manor ourselves. Too much of a chance someone in your pay would notice us. Maybe even someone working for his household."
"Try about half his household," said Sabatha. "So you needed that treasure delivered to Lavaris, and you fed me its location on that boat. Gods! How long had you known I had Nikoros under my thumb?"
"We found out nearly too late," said Locke. "Just about everything he gave you before the boat was legitimately at our expense."
To give him the word on the boat." She rubbed her temples. "Ah, that alchemical store I relieved you of in the Velvespala. That tip came from Nikoros. You must have given everyone you suspected word of some different juicy target."
"And the target you stepped on told us who the leak was," said Locke, grinning. "You have it exactly."
"You impossible assholes!"
Sabatha leapt up, moved around the table, pulled Locke and Jean from their chairs, and threw an arm around each of them, laughing.
"Oh, you two are such insufferable weaselly shits, it's marvellous!"
"You weren't so bad yourself," said Jean. "But for the grace of the gods, we might still be cruising the Amethyll."
"So what have we done?" said Sabatha, her voice full of honest wonderment. "What have we done? I suppose I won the election, but I'm not sure if winning it for about 30 seconds is winning it at all."
"Just as I'm not sure that nudging a victory into a tie is really the same as winning for our side," said Locke. "Nor is it quite losing. A pretty mess, isn't it? One for the drunkards and philosophers."
"I wonder what the Magi are going to say."
"I hope they argue about it from now until the sun grows cold," said Locke. "We did our bit,
We fought sincerely, we perverted the final results just enough to eternally confuse anyone watching. What more could they possibly want?
I suppose we find out now, said Jean.
Did Patience give you any instructions or hints about what to do once the ballots were counted? Said Sabitha.
Not a word, said Locke.
Then why don't we all get the hell out of here and let our employers find us in their own time? Sabitha tossed back the last of her brandy. I've got a safe house just off the Court of Dust. Rented it for a month, had firewood, linens, and wine laid in. I'd say it's as comfortable a place as any to rest and figure out what we're going to do next. She ran her fingers lightly over Locke's left arm.
Any plan to sneak us out of here without getting swept up in a brawl? Said Jean.
New skins. Sabitha produced a scalpel-thin dagger from somewhere in a jacket sleeve and used it to slit one of three paper parcels stacked beneath the chamber's unnerving fresco. Much as I hate to take this dress off display, I thought we'd find our exit that much easier if we dressed like the enemy. 4. At the 10th hour of the evening, a trio of bluecoats pushed through the curious crowds at the main entrance to the Carthenium. A slender watchman and a sturdy watchman, led by a woman with sergeant's pins on her lapels. They disposed of the last few people standing in their way with a combination of shoves and ominous mutterings about official business. Locke and Jean followed Sabitha about 50 yards west to a branching side court where a carriage waited. The night had darkened considerably, and as he opened the carriage door, Locke's eye was caught by an orange glare somewhere to the south.
"Looks like a fire," he said.
The conflagration rippled, gilding the shadowy buildings of what must have been the Palanta district with its light.
"Damned big one," said Jean. "I hope it's nothing to do with the election. Maybe these Carthani play harder than I ever gave them credit for."
"Come on, you two. Let's not linger long enough to get noticed by anyone who might outrank us," said Sabitha.
They all clambered into the carriage together. The driver, obedient to whatever orders Sabitha had given her earlier, shook the reins and they were off, leaving the results of their tampering with Carthane's electoral process behind them. Genuine bluecoats were still arriving in force, truncheons and shields drawn, as the carriage rattled over the paving stones, away from the Carthenium. Intersect 4. Ignition.
The first magistrate has just read the final district report, says one of the young men, his voice dreamy, his eyes unfocused.
Cold Marrow knows from long experience that the more tenuous and subtle mind-to-mind connections are the most demanding to sustain. Any damned fool can blaze their thoughts into the night for magi far and wide to receive like buzzing insects. The intelligence network now flashing thoughts across the city is straining itself to be utterly silent.
"The last district is Black Iris," whispers the young mage.
"Black Iris victory," says someone else, "by the skin of their teeth."
"It seems that Patience's vaunted Kamori were no match for ours," smirks Archidama Foresight. She wears a leather hood and mantle, a dark linen mask, a male-reinforced cuirass.
Like all the men and women in the second-floor solar of Cold Marrow's Palanta District House, she is dressed for a fight.
"We'll deal with them last, after all the other satisfactions of the evening have been dispensed with."
"Necessities, let us rather say,"
coughs Cold Marrow, taking deep, steady breaths to help rule his anxiety. The air is close, and it smells of all these magi, their robes and leathers, the wine on their breaths, the oils in their hair, their nervous, excited sweat.
"Why not both?" says the Archidama. "There's a disturbance at the Carthenium," whispers the young man who has been reporting on the election. "Someone, Lovaris of the Bursadi district, some sort of announcement. He may be switching sides." "Damn," says Archidama Foresight, "but it seems to me that there's no time like the present. All our targets must be absorbed in the distraction."
"Oh, they are," chuckles Cold Marrow. "It couldn't be working better. Are your people in their proper positions?"
"All of them,"
says Forsyte. Then here's to necessity, says Cold Marrow, his mouth suddenly dry, and to the future of all our kind. Cold Marrow speaks a word. The word becomes fire. A spark flashes in the dark heart of a jar of fire oil, one of 100 tightly sealed, placed in the space beneath the floor of the room a month before. This jar is half full, containing just enough air for the flame to breathe the vapors of the oil. The explosion is white hot, shattering the clay vessels, sucking air and oil into the roaring, all-devouring blast. Not even Magi can move faster than this, or protect themselves with so little warning. The floor moves beneath Cold Marrow's feet, then comes sharp, dark heat, stunning pressure, and sudden silence. Cold Marrow dies, taking 14 Magi with him, including Archidama Forsyte. He has no time to feel either regret or satisfaction. It will simply have to be enough. The war lasts 9 minutes. It is utterly one-sided, the only possible war Magi can wage with any hope of total victory against others trained in the same traditions, to the same standards. Archidama Forsyte's people discover that their own ambush is stillborn, their positions ready-made traps. They have always been outnumbered by the larger faction of Magi they derided as meek, and now those opponents apply their numbers to disprove the slander. No quarter is given, no fair fight allowed. Strength is brought against weakness, across rooftops, within lamp-lit gardens, inside the halls of the Issa Scholastica and the private homes of sorcerers, the assault is quick and silent and absolute. As the tipsy, confused politicians of Carthane clamber over one another in a comical brawl at the heart of the Carthenium, 70 Magi die in the dark places of the city, taking only a handful of their killers with them. Navigator finds patience alone in the sky chamber, staring at the bowl of the artificial heavens, currently mirroring the actual sky over Carthane, the rolling dark clouds summoned to lock the light of moons and stars away. Shadow has been drawn over the city like a cloak to better hide the evidence. "It's over," says Patience. She speaks real words to the air. The silver threads of thought speech have unraveled unpleasantly across Carthane. Cries of pain and betrayal, cries for help that will never come, and Patience has hardened her mind against most of the noise. "Now we have to live with ourselves." "Tell our troubles to the shades of Therimpel," says the one-armed woman. She wipes a tear from her cheek. "We are each one in a thousand thousand," says Patience. "We have destroyed some of the rarest and most precious things in the world tonight. Our distant inheritors may curse us for what we've done." "We already deserve their curses, Archidama. So long as there's still a world left for them to curse us in. Come now, help me do it." The two women bow their heads, move their hands in perfect concert, and speak words of unweaving that tear at their throats like desert air. The beautiful conjured heavens of the sky chamber fade like the memory of a dream, until there is nothing but a dome of plain white stones, grayed with the patina of old smoke. "Do you wish to see your son now?" says Navigator. "No," says Patience, suddenly feeling every one of her years, suddenly wishing for the touch and the laugh of a man who was taken by the Amethel half her lifetime ago. "I'll speak to Lamora first, but for now I want to be alone for a while." Navigator nods and quietly withdraws, leaving Patience alone in the silent vastness of a room that will never be used again. One final duty remains at the end of this long campaign, and Patience does not yet have the heart to face it. Last interlude. Thieves prosper. 1. The remains of Gennaro Bulidazi, last of his line, were taken away under his family colors. An apoplectic Brego did most of the work, after being rebuked for his panic and disbelief by Baroness Ezrintame. She did, however, graciously assign a number of constables to serve as an honor guard. It was the middle of the night before all the constables and soldiers decamped from within Gloriano's rooms,
chasing off the small crowd of locals and curiosity-seekers as they went. Baroness Ezrintame left only a small guard posted outside, their orders to preserve the peace for the nobles spending their last night in Espara within. Jean and Genora went off together early to spend that night as they saw fit. The Sansas, seemingly reluctant to let one another out of their sight, claimed a corner of the main room and drank with Alondo and Donka. Not the boisterous drinking of celebration, but the quiet ritual of people relieved to still have throats to pour their ale down. Bert and Chantal fell asleep on one another, wrapped up together in an old cloak. Mistress Gloriano promised Locke she would wake them eventually and pack them off to a proper room. She and Sylvanus then sat together, working on a ribbon-wrapped bottle of some expensive brandy whose existence had never previously been mentioned to the thirsty ingrates pounding her bar for service. Sabitha was clear and to the point, without words. She found Locke bound up in his thoughts in the main room and dispelled them with a hand on his shoulder. She glanced at the stairs by way of a question, and when he nodded, her smile made him feel something even the cheers of 800 strangers hadn't been able to. They commandeered an empty chamber. Sabitha used the room's only chair to wedge the door shut and admired her handiwork with grim satisfaction. They were tired. The smell of smoke was nestled deep in their hair, and the last thing they needed was more sweat without a bath, but neither of them cared. They were at home in the darkness in a way that only the survivors of places like Shades Hill could understand, and alive to one another's lips and hands as they had never been before. They were still shy, still awkward and unschooled, but if their first night together had been confusing and incomplete, their second, their second, taught them why people keep trying. Chapter 12. The End of Old Dreams. 1. The smell of her, the taste of her. Locke awoke in darkness, still awash in those things. His sweat, their sweat, had cooled and dried on his skin, and the bed. He ran his hands over her side of it and found it empty, the blanket thrown back. He remembered where he was, the upper room of Sabitha's house off the Court of Dust, the one with the expensively luxurious mattress and the Lashani silk sheets. He couldn't have been asleep for long. There was someone in the darkness watching him, and he knew in an instant it wasn't Sabitha, knew with every fibre of his intuition who it must be, standing by the faint grey cracks of light at the window.
"What have you done?"
he whispered.
"We spoke," said Patience. "I showed her something."
Soft silver light filled the room, the cold alchemical globes, in response to a mere gesture of Patience's. Locke saw her hands moving as his eyes adjusted, saw that she wore a heavy traveller's cloak, with the hood thrown back.
"Where's Jean?"
"Downstairs, where you left him," said Patience. "He'll awaken soon. Do you want to get dressed, or are you comfortable speaking like this?"
The cold, Locke felt, had little to do with the mere fact that he was naked. He slid from the bed, not caring that he concealed nothing from Patience, and dressed in what he could only hope, ludicrously, was somehow an insolent fashion. He donned trousers and tunic like armour, threw a simple dark jacket on as though it could keep Patience and her words out. Locke saw that there was something leaning against the wall behind Patience, a flat rectangular object about 3 feet high, covered in a grey cloth.
"She tried to write you a note," said Patience. "It was beyond her. She left half an hour ago."
"What did you do to her, Patience?"
"I did nothing."
Her dark eyes caught him, seemed to pierce him, those hunter's eyes.
"To my arts, Sabitha Bellacoras is a puppet waiting for a hand. But it would have been meaningless had I done anything. She had to choose. I gave her information that led to a choice."
"You utter bitch!"
"I also saved your life tonight," she said, "for the second and last time. This is our final conversation, Locke Lamora, if that's what you still choose to call yourself. I've come to render all dues and finish my business with you."
"Do you want to kill me yourself at last?"
"Certainly not."
"And
You mean to keep your word? Money and transportation to see us on our way?
There's no money and no transportation, said Patience, laughing without humor. You'll receive nothing else from us. Your counting house contacts will no longer recognize you, and your deep roots associates already think of Sebastian Lazari as a gray ghost of a memory. Wherever you gentlemen choose to go next, I suspect you have a long walk ahead of you.
Why are you doing this to us? Said Locke.
The Falconer, she said.
So revenge was the game after all, said Locke. Well, a creature like the Falconer deserved every second of hurt I ever gave him, and fuck you if you expect me to think otherwise.
You can't understand what you took from him, said Patience, her words hot and thick with scorn. Your flesh is inert. Magic is nothing more than the sound of the wind to you. You can never feel it, feel the words leaving you like fire, like arrows from a bowstring. To know that power welling beneath you and bearing you like a feather on the wind, you think I'm selfish for this? Cruel? It's less than you deserve. Killing him would have been mercy. I've killed Magi, but you stole his hands and his voice. You took the tools of magic from him and smashed him like a priceless work of art. You stole his destiny. The Arkadama Patience could forgive you. The mother and the mage cannot.
I refer you to my former statement, said Locke, his voice trembling. A heavy tread sounded on the stairs. Jean burst into the room, slamming the door aside without knocking.
I don't understand, he panted. I was just... You fucking did something to me again, didn't you?
A brief slumber, said Patience. I wanted time with Sabatha, and then with Locke. But you might as well hear everything else I have to say.
Where's Sabatha? Said Jean.
Alive, said Patience, and fled of her own accord.
Why do I...
You've got nothing more I want, Jean Tannen, said Patience. Interrupt me again, and Locke leaves Carthane alone.
Jean balled his fists, but remained silent.
I'm leaving Carthane too, said Patience, myself and all my kind. Tonight ends the last of the 5-year games and our centuries of life here. Whenever the Carthani find the nerve to enter the Issa Scholastica, they'll find our buildings empty, our tunnels collapsed, our libraries and treasures vanished. We are removing all trace of ourselves from Carthane down to the dust under our beds.
Why on the God's earth would you do such a thing? Said Locke.
Carthane is the old dream, said Patience. It served its purpose. We have gathered strength, honed our skills, and collected the wealth we need to do what we must. There will be no more contracts, no more bonds, Magi. We are retiring from the public life of this world. Never again can we allow such an institution as this to arise.
That danger you spoke of, said Locke, unnerved and startled by the magnitude of the changes Patience's words implied.
There are things moving and dreaming in the darkness, said Patience. We refuse to risk any further chance of waking them up. Yet human magic must survive, so we must learn how to make it as quiet as possible.
Why run us through this damned election? Said Locke. Gods, why not just put us in a room and tell us this shit and save us all so much trouble?
Wise members of my order a century ago, said Patience, foresaw our direction beyond a shadow of a doubt. We used our contracts to enrich ourselves, but they also made us arrogant. They fueled the impulse to dominate, to see our powers as limitless and the world as our clay. These wise men and women knew that a crisis would break, a time for blood, and the only way to win would be to achieve surprise. They envisioned a disruption of our ordinary lives so profound and yet so routine that it could conceal preparations for a fight when the time came. The 5-year games became a regular part of our society, a pageant and a release. But a few of us were always trusted with the original intention of the games, and the knowledge that we might have to employ it.
So it was all just a monumental misdirection? Said Locke.
While we danced for everyone's amusement, you sharpened your knife and stuck it in somebody's back?
All those magi that I once described as exceptionalists, said Patience, all those brothers and sisters, I mourn them, even as I know there was no convincing them. They will stay in Carthane forever. The rest of us go on.
Why tell us any of this? Said Jean.
Because I value your discomfort.
Patience smiled without warmth.
I described the conditions of your employment very succinctly. We are not vanishing from the world, merely from the eyes of ordinary people. Share our business with anyone, and you are always in our reach.
Ordinary people, said Locke. Well, how ordinary am I, really? What's the truth of all the tales you spun about my past?
You should look at the painting I brought for Sabatha.
Patience tapped the wrapped object leaning against the wall behind her.
I'm leaving it here, though in a day or two it will be nothing but white ash. It's the only portrait of L'Amour Acanthus ever painted during his life. I ought to tell you the likeness is impeccable.
A simple answer, shouted Locke. What am I?
You're a man who doesn't get to know the answer, said Patience, and now her smile was genuine.
She was shaking with the obvious difficulty of containing her laughter.
Look at you, Camori, confidence trickster. You think you know what revenge is? Well, here's mine on you. Before I was Arkidama Patience, I was called Seamstress. Not because I enjoy needlework, but because I tailor to fit.
Locke could only stare at her, feeling cold and hollow to the depths of his guts.
Live a good long life without your answer, she said. I think you'll find the evidence neatly balanced in either direction. Now one thing more will I tell you, and this only because I know it will haunt and disquiet you. My son preferred to mock my premonitions, but only because he didn't want to face the fact that they always have substance. I shall give you a little prophecy, Locke Lamora, as best as I have seen it. Three things must you take up, and three things must you lose before you die. A key, a crown, a child.
Patience pushed her hood up over her head.
You will die when a silver rain falls.
You're making all this shit up, said Locke.
I could be, said Patience. I very well could be, and that's part of your punishment. Go forth now and live, Locke Lamora. Live uncertain.
She gestured once and was gone. 2. Jean remained at the door, staring at the grey-wrapped package. Finally, Locke worked up the nerve to seize it and tear away the cover. It was an oil painting. Locke stared at it for some time, feeling the lines on his face draw taut as a bowstring, feeling moistness well in the corners of his eyes.
Of course, he said, of course. L'Amour Acanthus.
And wife, I presume. He made a noise that was half dour laugh and half strangled sob, and threw the painting on the bed. The black-robed man in the portrait looked nothing like Locke. He was broad-shouldered, with the classically dark, sharp aspect of a Therin-throne patrician. The woman beside him bore the same sort of haughty glamour down to her bones, but she was much fairer of skin. Her thick, flowing hair was as red as fresh blood.
"I'm everything Sabatha was afraid of," said Locke, "tailored to fit."
I'm sorry as hell I got you into this, said Jean.
Shit, don't go wobbly on me now, Jean. I was as good as dead, and the only way out of this was to go through, all the way to Patience's endgame. Now she's played it.
We can go after Sabatha, said Jean. She's had half an hour. How far could she get?
I want to, said Locke, wiping his eyes. Gods, I can still smell her everywhere in this room. And gods, I want her back!
He slumped onto the bed. But I promised to trust her. I promised to respect her decisions, no matter how much it fucking cut me. If she has to run from this, if she has to be away from me,
then for as long as she needs, I'll accept it. If she wants to find me again, what could stop her?
Jean put his hands on Locke's shoulders and bowed his head in thought.
You're gonna be fucking miserable to live with for a couple of weeks, he said at last.
Probably, said Locke with a rueful chuckle. I'm sorry.
Well, we should case this place and pack everything useful we can lay our hands on, said Jean. Clothes, food, tools. We don't have to go after Sabatha, but we'd best have our asses on the road before the sun peaks over the horizon.
Why?
Carthane hasn't kept up an army or maintained its walls for 300 years, said Jean. In a few hours it's going to wake up to discover that the only thing keeping it protected from the world at large has vanished during the night. Do you want to be here when that mess breaks wide open?
Oh, shit. Good point.
Locke stood up and looked around the room one last time.
Key, crown, child, he muttered. Well, fuck you, Patience. Three things must you kiss before I let you spook me for good. My boots, my balls, and my ass.
Locke pulled his boots on and followed Jean down the stairs, impatient to have Carthane at his back and slowly sinking into the horizon. Epilogue. Wings. 1. The boy is 6. He stares at the Emethel, breathes the lake air, the wholesome sense of life and freshness. He stares at the glinting lights, the jewels in the blackness, the secrets of the Eldrons scattered in the depths. The dockfolk claim that fishermen in the water at night have been driven mad by the lights, have dived down toward them, pulling frantically, as if toward the surface, until they drowned, or vanished. The boy is not afraid of the lights. The boy has power the dockfolk can only guess at. He feels a pressure in his temples when he stares out across the waters. He hears something lower and lovelier than the steady wash of the waves and the cries of the birds. The power of the hidden things calls to the power of the boy. The boy knows the Emethel took his father. He has been told this, but he remembers nothing. He was too young. There is no memory to mourn. The Lake of Jewels means only life, beauty, soothing familiarity. All these things, and the power that waits for his power to match it, to reveal it. 2. The boy is 4, the boy is 10, the man is 20. His body shifts in this place. Sometimes he is whole, sometimes he is pleased. Sometimes his memories are bright and vivid as paintings glowing with the fire of the gods in every speck of pigment. Sometimes he speaks in a rich rolling voice. Sometimes he moves his hands and feels the fingers there, feels them brushing over surfaces and picking things up. He does not know why this pleases him, why he feels something like the hot pressure of tears behind his eyes, why the joy is so bittersweet. Sometimes he walks in a fog. His thoughts are wrapped in dull cotton. Sometimes he is on a street and he is confused. He is bound with rope, throbbing with pain, his hands and his mouth caked with blood, his own blood. The rain comes down and men are staring at him, studying him, afraid. Sometimes he is gazing out across the Emethel, feeling the life of the bird for the first time. A gull, an elegant white thing, wheeling in tight circles. The boy feels its needs, its hunger, the elegant simplicity of the thing at the center of it all. The boy visualizes this as a wheel, a piece of clockwork, a logic circle turning without friction or remorse. Strike, eat, live on the wind. Strike, eat, live on the wind. The boy moves his fingers to call up his untutored power. He reaches out and takes the life of the bird like a humming thread in the hands that nobody else can see, the hands of power his mother has taught him to use. The bird is startled. Its wings fold awkwardly. It plummets 20 feet and bounces hard off a rock, then plops into the water, fluttering and squawking agitatedly. Lucky its wings aren't broken. The boy needs practice. 3. The boy is 10. The boy has run across the hills and forests north of Carthane all night with blood in his mouth. The boy has crouched in the center of a web, still as stone, with venom in his fangs and the faintest sensation of movement rippling across his fur, the air currents of prey fluttering ever closer. The boy has swept high into the sky, chased the sun, learned to strike, eat, and live on the wind.
"You must not," his mother insists. His mother is powerful. His mother is teaching him her gifts, but she will not let him teach her his own. "It is not highly thought of among our kind," she says. "You are a man. You will think as a man. There's no room for a man in those tiny minds."
"I share," said the boy. "I command. I don't feel small. If they really are tiny, perhaps I make them big whenever I go inside."
"You will grow more and more sensitive," says his mother. "You will tie yourself more and more tightly to them, do you understand? Their lives will become yours, their feelings yours. If they are hurt, you will share all their pain. If they are killed, you may be lost as well."
The boy doesn't understand. His mother tells him these things as though there were no compensations. The boy knows that he is alone, among all the magi his mother has presented him to, in his willingness to share the lives of animals. There is no dissuading the boy. He has tasted life without regrets, life without remorse, life lived on the wind. It is what he is. He returns to himself after each communion, feeling that part of the wild has come with, to live inside him. His mother could make him stop. Even at 10, the boy knows what she holds over him, burns with shame at it, but she will not use it. She lectures and begs and threatens, but she will not speak the thing that would lock his will in an iron strongbox. She cannot or will not, but it doesn't make the boy forgive her. He casts his awareness into hidden places for owls, ravens, hawks. He hurls himself into the sky, carrying anger from the ground, and hot blood runs on his talons. He soars to forget he has legs. He kills to forget he has rules and expectations. He never shares this experience with anyone else. He goes alone to the woods, and dead songbirds fall like rain. When he is shamed in his studies or rebuked for his attitude, he remembers the blood on his talons, and he endures with a smile. 4. The boy is gone. The man is 25. The man is lost. Sometimes he is in the dead grey place. His legs refuse to move. His hands feel like crippled lumps. His tongue throbs with a phantom pain, an electric tingle. He is trapped on a bed as though nailed to it. He cannot remember how he came to be in this place. He sobs, panics, tries to claw his way to freedom with his missing fingers. Only the smell of the lake relaxes him, the cool, fresh scent of the water, the occasional piquancy of dead fish or gull shit. When the wind blows these things to him, he can bear the confusion and the torture of the dead place. When the wind is wrong, the shadows around him pour something cold and bitter down his throat, and he goes into the darkness cursing them wordlessly. 5. The lake air blows through the dead place. He takes it in as though no other air will sustain him. It is night. The darkness is offset by the light of a single lamp. Everything is strange. He feels a buoyant force inside his chest, something rising through him like bubbles in a spring. The room is clarifying, as though layer after layer of gauze is being removed from his face. The light stings his eyes. The new clarity is unnerving. There are shadows moving near the light, two of them. The man tries to speak, and a strangled, wet moan startles him. It takes a moment to realize that the noise is his own, that his tongue is a scrap of cauterized stump. His hands. He remembers Camor, remembers steel coming down, remembers the shared pain of Vestris' last moments washing over him in unbearable waves. He remembers Locke Lamora and Jean Tannen. He remembers Luciano Anatolius. He is the falconer, and the air in the room is heavy with the smell of the amethel. He is alive and back in Carthane. How long? He feels stiff, light, weak. Significant weight has vanished from his body. Has it been weeks, months?
Nearly 3 years,
whispers a soft voice in his head, a familiar voice, a heated voice. He rasps, the best he can do. The frustration comes on like a physical weight. He can sense the currents of magic in the room, feel the strength of his mother nearby, but his tools are missing. The power is there to be wielded, but his will slides from it like sand off smooth glass.
I'll take care of it for both of us.
Cold fingers of force slide across his mind, and the impotence blessedly is lifted. He feels the words as he crafts them, feels them going out to her, mind to mind, his first orderly communication in 3 years?
3 years!
As I said,
Camor.
Yes, the Anatolius contract.
How badly was I injured? What did they do to me?
Not enough to cause your present condition.
The falconer ponders the import of these words, flips desperately through his memories like the pages of a book. A dream steel model of a city, its towers falling into flat silvery nothingness. Archidama patience in the sky chamber, warning him that he is headed into danger. Steel rising and falling, cauterizing heat, white bolts of pain in his mind unlike anything he has ever imagined. Vestris dead. Before the blade can come for his tongue, he tries to work the spell of pain-deadening, the old familiar technique, but on the other side of it, not welcome relief. Fog, madness, prison.
Now see it all.
Patience speaks a word, and something comes loose in his mind. A patina cracks over an old memory, revealing the truth within the shell. Archidama Patience, the night of his departure, a brief private audience, she warns him again. Again he scoffs at the transparency of her ploys. She speaks another word then, and the word is urgent and irresistible. The word is his name, his true name, uttered as the cornerstone of a spell. He is bound to it, then made to forget.
You did it.
A subtle compulsion, a trap, an irrevocable order sleeping in his mind until the next time he used the art of deadening pain.
You did this to me.
You did it to yourself.
You did this to me!
I gave you the chance to avoid it.
No, the chance to show my throat.
Your arrogance again. Can't you see that you were a problem in want of a solution?
And your solution, assassination, far from home.
I suppose that's the only honest way to look at it.
I'm your God's damned son.
I wear 5 rings. You put yourself on the wrong side of them.
Well, he forces himself to lower his mental voice, to think coolly. There must be danger here. Why is she telling him this, revealing all after 3 years? You certainly fucked things up, didn't you?
All I could foresee was that you were headed into serious pain. Therefore, I assumed that you would be in extreme danger, that you would do the obvious thing.
Paralyze myself, you mean, and then it would all be over.
Except your opponents were scrupulous.
Ah, is this what scrupulous treatment feels like? Lucky, lucky me.
I told you, it's not what I wanted.
You and your God's damned prescience, your snide little hints, the way you tried to control everyone around you with them. What good was it if you couldn't even see this coming at us? Tell me, Mother, have you ever managed to have a vision of your own future?
No.
Well, that must be pleasant for you, to be the only real person in your whole damned world, and all the rest of us puppets for your private stage. How does it feel now?
It's over, says Patience, switching to actual speech.
She is beside his bed now, looking down at him.
All of it. Your associates are dead. Arkidama Forsyth is dead.
How?
Irrelevant. You are the sole survivor of your faction. All questions between us have been settled. We're leaving Carthane, entering the time of quiet as planned. You are my final item of business before I go.
Come to kill me last. Come to bring an end to 3 years of cowardice.
Part of me wishes you were dead, she says. Wishes you'd died cleanly, as you would have had you been healthy and abroad in Carthane tonight. I can't imagine wanting to live on in your condition. And I will end your suffering, if it's what you desire. But I felt that I had to ask. I owe you at least this much.
She points to the other figure in the room, a burly man, balding, with a black moustache that droops to the collar of his brown tunic. There are no rings visible on either of his wrists.
This is Eganis, your caretaker.
She offers images and impressions, revealing to the falconer how it has been for 3 years. Eganis moving him, rolling him from side to side, turning him to avoid weeping bedsores. Eganis feeding him, gruel and pap and milk. Eganis emptying his chamber pot. Eganis walking him, leading the doddering falconer by a length of leather around his neck. A mage of Carthane, leashed.
It was necessary to preserve your health.
Like a dog.
It was necessary.
Like a god's damned dog.
You're the one who always sought to know the spirits of animals more intimately.
He sends no words, but an unrelieved outpouring of hatred so hot and acidic he sees her stagger before she can manage to gird her mind against it.
You'll understand when you calm down, she says. I'll leave this house and funds for Eganis to draw on. Without hands or voice, you're now effectively one of the ungifted, and you will never see any of us again. If you can find some reason to live, you are invited to do so. If you find the thought unpalatable, then I will end the matter quickly and painlessly.
I will accept nothing more from you for so long as I live. Not this house, not Eganis, not charity, certainly not death.
On your own head be it, she mutters. Eganis will stay.
You're a mute invalid with 3 rings tattooed on your wrist, and Carthane could soon be a very interesting place for you.
There's no hell for you deep enough to suit my tastes, mother.
Your ambitions and your researches were a threat to every living being on this world. Consider that when you cry your tears.
Your timidity! In the face of the secrets waiting to be unlocked everywhere the Eldrin set foot, you want us to stay ignorant and helpless. Well, to hell with you. All the real power of the human race is squandered on people like you, the willfully small. You and all your fellow punchlines to Carthane's worst joke. 5 rings, 5 prisoners' shackles.
You would have been free to stick your hand into fire if only the rest of us wouldn't have to burn with you. Goodbye, falconer.
She departs, and the spell of thought-shaping crumbles in her absence. He is alone and voiceless with Eganis. The man looks at the falconer, then slightly away, as though uncomfortable at seeing him with his eyes open.
If you ever find the burden of your new life too overwhelming, the man mutters, I am instructed to offer you mercy. I have powders that can be taken in wine.
The falconer glares at the man until he shrugs and leaves the room. 6. Now the falconer notices the autumn cold. He feels it like an ache in his too thin body. Disgusted, he rolls to his left and attempts to stand on his own 2 feet. Success, but only just. Gods, he moves like a man of 90. His hips ache and his legs seem too stick-thin to bear him. But they do, awkwardly. The falconer chortles disgustedly at the creaky hop that passes for his walk. There is nothing useful in this prisoner's chamber. A bed, a chair, a lamp, a chamber pot. The next room is larger, furnished with a library of several dozen volumes and a small basin. The falconer hops wistfully to the basin, knowing what he'll see there. Dream steel is ubiquitous in mage households, a decoration and an amusement. The pool is inert to him, dead as water, and the frustration makes him shudder so hard he nearly falls over. Lips trembling, he prods the silver pool with the remnants of his right hand. He needs fingers, flexible fingers. Then this steel could take any shape required at the press of a thought. When he was 5, he could move the metal with a wave of his hands and a single word. Fresh heat rises in his cheeks, and for an instant he hates what he has become so fiercely he actually considers the powders offered by the caretaker. The surface of the dream steel ripples in a place where he isn't touching it. The falconer leaps back, heart hammering, piteously loud in his weak chest. Gods, if his eyes are tricking him! If he didn't actually see that, he tells himself, he'll demand the powders. His teeth are rattling from excitement as he bends back over the basin. He touches the severed stumps of his fingers to the liquid and stares at it, mustering all of his willpower from its long slumber, all of his fury, all of his inhumanly honed focus and desire. Beads of sweat pour down his forehead. He shudders with a yearning so profound his breath comes in gasps. Hair-thin strands of dream steel creep onto the stump of his right index finger. Then thick drops, then a tangible curving line. He feels power like a vibration along the silver edge. His grip on the energy of sorcery, his focus, hot tears drench his cheeks, and his chest heaves like a bellows. In a minute he has crafted a single silvery finger, and the process gains speed. With one finger to direct the currents of magic, it is easy to craft a second, even easier to craft a third. Before he can believe it, the falconer is staring in awestruck joy at a half-metal hand, held together by the trivial flexions of his will, 4 silver fingers and a silver thumb. His wail of relief and joy is so loud and undignified that Iganis comes running from below. The man's eyes widen.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
There's no need for the old device, the playing of a silver thread back and forth. The falconer's hand will now do the job itself. He flexes his mirror-skinned fingers, makes a brush-off gesture toward Iganis, and the caretaker falls gasping to his knees. The falconer has power, but it is weak and vague. He needs a voice. Some magic only makes him more desperately thirsty to have it all back. Thirsty, the very idea, and yet, why not? What can caution possibly do for him now? He takes the dream steel basin in his new hand and tilts it into his mouth. The metal is cool and strangely salty. It pools beneath the stump of his tongue, slides in tendrils down his gullet, and there he holds it, shapes it, not as a tongue, but as a thin, resonant surface, vibrating half with sound and half with magic. Eerie noises like hissing laughter fill the room as he fights to master the dream steel, to align it perfectly, to gild his throat.
"Iganis!"
he booms at last. The voice is cold, the words like metal grates sliding shut.
"So, you would have offered me mercy, Iganis? You offer me mercy?"
"Please," the caretaker coughs. "I meant you no harm. I've taken care of you."
"I refused you as a gift."
The falconer seizes the basin and hurls it at Iganis, spilling the remaining dream steel over him.
"My mother should have sent you away."
He moves his silver hand and speaks in his silver voice. The dream steel comes alive and crawls over Iganis, rolling toward his neck.
"No, please, I can serve you."
"You will serve me, as proof of concept."
The falconer makes a fist, and the loose dream steel flows into Iganis' ears. Parallel red lines pour out beneath the silver ones, and then become rivers. Iganis screams. He clutches the top of his head, and there is a sound like wheat husks cracking. The skull shatters. A wave of silver fountains out behind hot blood and wet brains. The results hit the floor in many different parts of the room. The falconer calls the loose dream steel back to him, forming a necklace with it. He'll need to secure more, somehow, to craft another functional hand. Still, what he has should be more than enough to give him back his wild sky. 7. There is a narrow window beside the bookshelf. A gesture from the falconer and the glass becomes sand, sliding out of the frame, blowing away into the blackly overcast night. Another gesture and the frame hinges rust. The falconer pulls it out of the wall and lets it clatter to the floor. He sees that he is somewhere in the Ponta Corbessa, just a block or two north of the docks. He sends his awareness forth, softly and subtly, well aware that none of the magi still abroad in the city will show him an instant's mercy if he is located. It takes only moments to find what he wants, one of the fan-tailed carrion crows of the North Amethel, sly, sociable birds with sharp eyes, sharp beaks, and sharp talons. The falconer takes the first crow gently and launches it into the night, using a slim thread of awareness, suppressing his delight at the sensation of soaring. A moment or two reaffirms his affinity for the work, and he extends his control to the half-dozen other crows roosting nearby. The falconer's purloined murder circles over the Ponta Corbessa, hunting both for other crows and a glimpse of a certain cloaked woman. She must still be somewhere in Carthane, and he'll know her at any distance, so long as she isn't hidden away under a deep spell. 7 crows become 30. The falconer directs them with the precision of a dancing master, sending more and more of his awareness out into the feathered cloud, seeing not through individual pairs of eyes, but as a thrilling gestalt, a whirling composite of dark streets, rooftops, rattling carriages, and hurrying people. 30 crows become 60, 60 becomes 90. They unwind in orderly spirals, north and west, search tirelessly. It doesn't take long to find her at the western edge of the Ponta Corbessa. She is walking alone, towards some rendezvous, and the falconer recognizes her beyond all possibility of doubt. Blood calls to blood. His flights of crows, black against the black sky, converge and circle silently, 300 feet up. In moments he has gathered 150, the most living creatures of any sort he has ever controlled at once. His mind is on fire with the thrill of power. Now he has to be quick and certain, before patience can bring her formidable skills into play, before any other magi can notice what's going on. 1 crow flutters and falls out of the night. The rest follow a heartbeat later. Patience is on the pavement beside a warehouse, just passing under a swaying orange alchemical lamp. The first crow shoots past her hood from behind, brushing it, squawking and cawing all the way. She whirls to see where it came from. The next dozen birds fly directly into her face. Eyes, nose, cheeks, lips. There is no time to be merciful. The ball of sorcery-maddened crows pecks and claws at anything soft, anything vulnerable. Patience barely has time to scream before she is blind and on her back, flailing as more crows pour out of the sky like a black cloud given flesh. She remembers her sorcery and half manages a spell. A dozen birds flash into cinders, but a dozen more take their place, seeking neck and forehead, wrists and fingers. The falconer presses Patience down to the pavement, the writhing flock a pure extension of his will, a crushing, dark hand. Grinning madly, he channels a thought-sending to her, hurling his sigil against her shattered mental defenses, and then...
"Is this weakness, mother? You never understood my talents. The truth is, they never made me weak. The truth is that they gave me wings."
The beaks and claws of the carrion birds are driven by human intelligence. In moments they have opened Patience's wrists, pulped her hands, peeled the skin from her neck, torn out her eyes and tongue. She is helpless long before she dies. The falconer disperses his clouds of winged minions and sags against the window frame, gasping for breath. He has expended so much of himself. He needs food. He must tear the house apart for anything useful. He needs clothing, money, boots. He must be away as soon as he's eaten, away from this nest of his enemies, away to recover himself.
The time of quiet, mother?
He hums the words softly to himself, savoring the eerie sensation of the dream steel vibrating in his throat.
Oh, I think the last fucking thing your friends are going to enjoy is a time of quiet.
Hobbling uneasily, laughing to himself, he moves carefully down the stairs. First food, then clothes, then to gather strength for the work ahead. The long, bloody work ahead. This concludes The Republic of Thieves by Scott Lynch. Narrated by Michael Page. Copyright 2013 by Scott Lynch. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with the Bantam Dell Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2013 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.